Hello and welcome to this week's Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I am joined today by Algie Hall. How are you doing, Algie?
Hi, very well, thanks, John.
Excellent. And Nilushi Karunaratne, for the first time, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
Excellent. You've been with us for a while, but first time on the podcast.
Yes.
It's very exciting. Very exciting. You've written the cover feature this week, which is about energy and essentially the UK's generating mix and what's happening there and how investors can play that. And it's a fantastic feature that really talks us through exactly where we are, where we've been, where we are and where we're going with this, and lots of actionable stuff in there for investors. So we'll talk about that in a minute. And Algie, we're going to talk about your stock screen this week.
Yes, which is small cap, high yield shares.
Small cap. Should we start with that? Small cap, okay. High yield. It sounds very exciting. And in fact, it is... Well, an incredibly good performing stock screen.
Yeah, no, it's outperformed the indexes I kind of take the stocks from every year since I started covering it 7 years ago.
Probably the only one. I mean your stock screens often do well, but they always have those blips.
Yeah, and, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, it's a screen. It's kind of, they're quite rough and ready by nature. So, you kind of don't expect them to just outperform. But this one has. And so, I do what I always do in this situation. I caution that people should expect it to end.
You suggest it's an anomaly.
An anomaly.
And not an infallible strategy.
Yes, indeed.
But why do you think this has been such a strong performer?
Well, I mean, the small cap yields, high yield small caps, I should say, they are interesting because... if you pick them right, you're picking kind of, you know, growth companies as well as high yielding shares. So you have a yield which grows. What the screen looks for is really quite basic in terms of, you know, indicators that these are shares which have a growing yield on them. It kind of looks for historic growth, forecast growth, then like, you know, some kind of safety measures like good interest cover and good dividend cover.
I've actually heard, a lot of sort of income managers who are interested in income growth rather than, you know, just high income. I mean, they're often prepared to accept quite a low yield if they think it's going to grow, a low dividend if they think it's going to grow. But these numbers here in the 2019 selection, they're pretty chunky yield.
Yes, yeah. And what this screen does, it looks for a yield in the top third of all yielding shares screened. So it's not, you know, it's not shy about trying to pick out a high yield. And But we do
worry about high yield sometimes.
Yeah, no, and my assumption with the screen was, you know, when I originally came up with it, my concern is that, you know, the yield was too high that it was looking for. But so far, it hasn't proven the case. And also, I mean, with small caps, you do get companies which just are overlooked. And I mean, some of the companies highlighted this year, especially the three passing all of the tests, companies which kind of, you know, just, you know, get on with their business. They're not, they are producing growth, but it's not the kind of super exciting growth that small cap investors tend to get obsessed with and, you know, end up pumping the shares to the sky kind of thing. These are companies producing, you know, decent growth. There's uncertainty in their outlook. You know, they're real kind of trading businesses, but they've got good, consistent records.
Mm. I mean, the one that that tops the list, I've never heard of before, and I edit the Investors Chronicle, and I've never heard of this company. This sounds appalling.
It used to be called Martin and Co. And that's top franchise.
Okay, that's why I haven't heard of it. That's why I haven't heard of it.
They've bought other franchises. Martin & Co. is still by far its biggest franchise. They bought other estate agency franchises over the year, and they're a group of different brands which they franchise, including. They've got an online brand, an internet brand, a hybrid brand, as they call it, called YouMove, but it's not spelled Y-O-U, it's spelled U as in a sheep.
As in a sheep.
A female sheep, E-W-E. I don't know why. But anyway, apparently this is quite a successful brand, scores very well in terms of customer satisfaction, actually kind of tops some of the polls, the Trustpilot poll.
Okay, so I mean, the company is actually now called the Property Franchise Group.
Yes, the Property Franchise Group. It's teeny. It's 39 million, but it's got an exceptional record for dividend growth, and it's also accompanied by really good cash conversion. as you'd expect with a franchise, you know, franchises are great for converting cash generally.
Is it general estate agency or is it focused on any particular
lettings.
Aspect? It's lettings.
So yeah, the more kind of dependable part of that market. So it's about 70% lettings. But then there's so much regulation, which has come and is coming down the pipes, and also potentially more depending on the outcome of the election. But
we'll come on to that when we talk about power.
there's just that big risk of, you know, no one quite knows the future, but people are still going to need to let properties. And actually, it because they offer a managed service, they're actually providing a service which in some ways gets more valuable the more regulation there is, because landlords actually need a professional management service. They can't, you know, get away with doing it themselves so easily without taking on a lot more risk of making a slip up and ending up seriously out of pocket.
Yeah, I mean, it's become much more difficult to be a private buy-to-let landlord.
Yes,
and it's health and safety, a lot of the stuff that they have to do.
Exactly. I mean, there are things like, you know, boiler checks and, you know, things like that. If you don't do it right and have the right paperwork, you can you can suffer really quite harsh consequences as a landlord.
So what are the financial characteristics of this business that has seen it top this screen?
It's had great dividend growth. So it's listed in 2014 with paying 4p is fully a dividend. And last year it paid 8.4p. It upped the interim dividend by 6%. So it's got that consistency of dividend growth. And then it's...
Cover looks good.
Cover looks good. It's always looked good. And it kind of converts... It tends to generate more cash than it does profit each year, which is a fantastic characteristic for a business. It's kind of, you know, that when you have a business which is trading at quite a low P like this one is, so this is a 10 times, but you've actually got free cash flow coming in most years ahead of earnings, then there's actually value there, which you don't see from looking at those earning numbers potentially. And then also, because it doesn't really have to invest very much to expand, because it's because the franchisees put in the money to, you know, run the actual estate agent.
Presumably this is what helps the cash profile.
That helps the cash profile, and it means it's got a very high return on capital employed. But then, I mean, it's got all these regulatory pressures. Also, you know, the sale transaction market isn't so good. So
yeah, and there's obviously lots of trends around the kind of shift from ownership to renting, which we've seen. Mm-hmm. It's quite strong. You know, ownership has peaked and actually is declining. So more people are renting.
Yeah, but and then as that happens, you know, renting a property becomes it becomes more work, more professionalised, but. You know, this could be good, but it is also, you know, it's also a risk. It's one of those things you don't quite know. And with small companies also, the future's always uncertain because it doesn't take much to go wrong for them to have a terrible year.
Politicians don't like landlords either very much.
They don't.
They are a soft target.
Yeah.
Where's the growth coming from? And I think it's something you look at towards the end of the piece. Services.
I mean, the core business... You know, they're basically trying to mitigate most of the regulation, but the growth is coming from online, and then also the potential to launch financial services, which they've got an announcement about. I think they've said the beginning of next year.
And what's
planning to have an announcement. So the idea is, at the moment, they don't really incentivize their agents to sell financial services, and a lot of agents sell a lot of financial services and make a lot of money from it. But so they think they found a kind of partnership-ish. I don't know if it is an actual partnership, but an arrangement with someone who's providing that kind of financial advice, which would allow their agents to share in the reward of selling those services.
Makes sense.
And and that could be, you know, a great addition for a company which generates 1% of revenue from financial services to make it become something, you know, fairly substantial through a very capital-light way of rolling the service out. I mean, that's great when you've got challenges in the main market.
Yeah, a really interesting company.
It is really interesting company. And it's teeny, 39 million. Who's going to look at it, really?
You have.
I have.
This week.
Because of this stock.
Hooray. I mean, there are some other interesting companies on this list. I go, I mean, just outside the top three, read the magazine, see what the other two are. You've got Shoezone, which I've always thought.
I know. Ooh.
Ooh. But it's, I mean, it's kind of a well-run company.
I mean, this is a company run for, you know, for the dividends in many ways. It's kind of, it's okay. I mean, it kind of knows what it's doing in terms of taking on short leases and selling cheap shoes. Its trading tends to be choppy. Samara Enterprises is on there.
I've had a bit, had a bit of trouble recently.
Yeah, it has. Really has.
But it's a good business.
It is.
Fundamentally a good business, but
it's very cyclical. Don't trust that yield, I'd say, though. And Character Group just lost Peppa Pig. Oh, no, it hasn't lost Peppa Pig, but it may lose Peppa Pig.
Yeah, this is the
Hasbro has taken over Entertainment One.
Yeah.
And they make Peppa Pig toys.
Oh, dear.
Or it was for Entertainment One.
Is this the year, Algie, when small cap, high yield comes a cropper?
Well, yeah, definitely looking at some of these ones. MC Saatchi, accounting issues. What else? There are a few
S3,
others,
a recruiter?
S3, yeah.
I mean, how do you think of recruiters, Lucy?
Well, I cover the recruiters and they've been taking quite a hammering recently.
It could be the bottom.
Well, it could be the bottom. I mean, this is the whole Brexit thing.
Well, yeah, no,
you know,
totally.
Uncertainty, you know, that's seeing companies delay recruitment or delay investment. You know, yeah. It could be the worst behind us now.
You're seeing it across a lot of industries, actually. They're kind of waiting to see whether that relief will come. If a solution eventually comes along, it could unlock and unleash a lot of growth for these companies that's kind of being held back.
Fingers crossed, eh? I think, you know, what happens in the election is obviously going to have a huge impact on whether this potential is unleashed. But yeah, I must admit, I've not been paying the election a huge amount of attention.
Good for you.
I'm so bored with politics. I really am. As I mentioned in my editorial this week. Yeah, I mean, and last year, I mean, it was there's some funny old companies in this. There is one here that I have never got my head around. Best of the Best.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Have you ever seen this?
Never seen it, no.
You have. If you've ever been through an airport, you'll see like some high performance car there.
And I don't know what it is.
And you can enter a competition to win this car. And it's an incredibly brilliantly performing company.
Very, very unpredictable in terms of when you look at the business and try and figure out how people are forecasting for, you know, what it's kind of based on. But it kind of comes around year and, year on year and pays quite a handsome dividend. Mm. I don't know what dividends it paid last year. But I'm just looking at its performance, you know, did a total return of 22% over the 12 months.
And Property Franchise Group up there as well.
Yeah, no, one of the best performers from last year. And then, I mean, yeah, you know, you've got lots of kind of, you know, cyclicals in there, which, things like Billiton, which is a really nice little company, which I wrote about last year when I did this screen. But it's got a cyclical end market and it has to employ quite a lot of capital because of the structural steel that it makes. So it's, interesting companies.
We like dividend-paying small caps. We do. And private investors are in a good position when it comes to these sort of companies because
no one else is looking at them.
No one else is looking at them. And, you know, they're sort of under the radar, the big income managers, because they're too small.
Yeah.
It's great. So we talk power?
Yes.
I don't know what's been said. As I said, I've been trying to avoid politics. So I assume we've had the Labour manifesto today. Have they talked about energy? They usually do.
I mean, I believe they touched on it. Yes. I mean, they brought out a commitment back in sort of September, October. And really, the big thing in energy now is offshore wind. We currently have a target where we're looking to have about 30 gigawatts of our energy coming from offshore wind. And Labour announced that they're going to push that up to 52 gigawatts. And what they really want to do is they're saying, we need a lot more offshore wind farms, and we're going to have a public-private partnership where the state takes a majority stake in that. So we think that'll really boost the sector and get us up to their target and put the UK on the way to its kind of net zero emissions target.
But I mean, as you say in your introduction, the UK is doing pretty well already in terms of its energy mix. I mean, we've had some amazing things this year. Coal has pretty much disappeared from the grid. Oh, it's at 5% now.
Yes, definitely. I mean, we're sort of undergoing an energy revolution right now, and it's been building for a little while. So in terms of the electricity we get from renewables, about 5 years ago, that was sort of just under 20% of our electricity came from renewables. And last year, that had bumped up to a third. And it's not just about kind of the environmental concerns that are driving this anymore. It's become cheap enough now that this is really going to push forward in a big way. And you've got some projections saying that by about 2050, 87% of our electricity is going to come from renewables.
It's quite complicated, though. So there are some problems with renewables, which you address in the feature. Perhaps talk us through what they are.
Yes. So, I mean, the economics of it are stacking up now. So it's become a lot cheaper. For example, there's something called the Contract for Difference scheme that the government runs, and that's kind of designed to boost investment in renewables. So when they first ran this scheme back in 2015, offshore wind farms were being guaranteed a price of something like £117 per megawatt hour.
And this is what they call the strike price,
yes,
usually.
That's the strike price. And in the most recent auction, I think the results were released in September, that had dropped to about £39, which is actually below the wholesale price of electricity, which means that new offshore wind farms aren't going to have to be subsidized anymore. So the founder of Bloomberg New Energy Finance, he described sort of these tipping points. So one of them is where power from newly constructible renewable sources is cheaper than building new fossil fuel generation. The second one actually is where building new sources of renewable power becomes cheaper than the existing fossil fuels that you're running. And we're sort of moving towards that second point now, where it's cheaper to sort of invest in new renewables than run the existing sort of coal and gas assets that we have. So the question is then, can we just not simply shift towards 100% renewables? And that's kind of where the critics say, wait, hold on a second. We have this thing called intermittency. So you can't generate electricity from these renewable assets when the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining. So you're still going to need some sort of balancing source of energy. And there's a lot of debate over what that comes from. I mean, some people are pushing for nuclear, but when you look at the price of that, I mean, Hinkley's strike price is £92.50. I mean, you've got EDF saying, let us build Hinkley, and then let us build the next one that we want to do as well. And
I'd rather they didn't, because that's right near my house, but there you go.
I mean, aside from the safety concerns and, you know, whatever other concerns there are with nuclear, just the economics alone of it, I mean, their second one would only come down to about maybe £70, and that's still a lot higher than what you're seeing from renewable energy.
Mm.
I mean, if nuclear is sort of ruling itself out, we've been reliant on coal for a long while, but as you mentioned earlier, that's dropped down to about 5% of where our electricity comes from now. And really what that's been shifted to instead is gas, because it's a much cleaner source of, you know, a way of getting electricity from fossil fuels.
And these things, I guess it goes back to the intermittency point. The beauty of a gas turbine is you can literally just fire it up when you need to.
That's the whole point as well. I mean, and the problem with intermittency as well is you can actually be getting too much power from these renewable sources. And the way our grid is set up, because it was built around sort of getting our energy from fossil fuels like coal and gas, it's not set up for these renewables right now. So when there's actually too much, they have to switch off these renewable assets and they have to bring online the gas assets that we have.
So I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of investment required, especially at the grid level. I mean, this is National Grid, whose results you covered this week. What have they said about the future of energy and how they're going to adapt to this revolution that's taking place?
I mean, so National Grid has something called the Electricity Systems Operator. It's part of what they do. And that's what actually controls the grid infrastructure. And they've said, yes, we need to change the grid. We need to adapt it because they acknowledge that this renewables revolution is coming along. And as the UK moves towards its net zero target, more renewables are going to be part of our electricity feed. So they're planning on getting the grid ready for renewables by about 2025. They're saying we'll be able to accommodate what renewables are going to feed into the grid.
That's quite soon.
I mean,
that's a big project to do in pretty much 5 years.
I mean, it is quite soon. But at the same time, National Grid is also investing in something interesting called interconnectors. So these are kind of underwater cables that connect the UK up to the grids of our neighbouring countries. So in terms of dealing with this intermittency problem as well, you can also then source your electricity from other countries to kind of smooth out you know, what you're getting.
Or ship it out, presumably, if you're generating too much at any given point.
Yes, but actually the UK is a net importer of electricity right now. But also as kind of Europe decarbonises electricity, you're actually importing in renewable energy from them as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. Where are we internet connecting to? I think Norway is mentioned in the piece.
So National Grid is actually building the longest interconnector in the world right now from Norway. It's going from, I think, somewhere in Northumberland. So it's going to connect us in Norway's hydro assets. And Norway is actually, I think, one of the cleanest energy generating countries in the world right now. So we're going to be getting their hydro energy. There's also, I think, a link to France, National Grid at the beginning of this year. I think it's Nemo Link connects to Belgium. Also, I think we've got one to Ireland as well.
Mm. I've actually heard talk of one to Iceland at some point as well, because they obviously have geothermal, which we don't have here, but
yes,
still perhaps a pipe dream. Sounds expensive. And how does this affect the numbers of National Grid? It's a popular share.
Yes, I mean, they're not actually, as far as I'm aware, they're not making any profit off it right now. I think by the mid-2020s, they're saying they want it to contribute, or they're aiming for it to contribute around £250 million of EBITDA. That's all the guidance they've given so far. It's part of their kind of National Grid Ventures arm is what they call it. I mean, if you're looking at what's going on with the rest of National Grid right now, it's quite interesting what they do versus sort of other utilities perhaps that we cover, because they kind of straddle both sides of the Atlantic. And the whole point is, I mean, I don't know how seriously you take this threat of nationalization, but when it comes to National Grid, the going theory is that, you know, kind of that US unit will help kind of offset any earnings pressure that would happen in the UK. But then National Grid has got their own problems going on in the US right now. They're kind of engaged in this battle in the state of New York over a new gas pipeline. And they've kind of been served notice almost that if they don't meet the governor's demands, that they could have their license revoked. So the outcome of that's kind of uncertain right now. It sort of adds to a more uncertain picture. And the reason why you'd hold a stock like National Grid really is for its dividend. So we don't really like that earnings uncertainty, and the free cash flow cover of the dividend isn't great right now, which I think is really why we have it on a hold right now.
Mm. I mean, it is a decent dividend yield though.
It's decent, but I would suggest jumping on that train at this point.
It's absolutely fascinating. One thing we haven't mentioned in terms of intermittency is energy storage, and this potentially changes everything again.
Precisely. So, I mean, the critics was what's happening right now is, you know, it's intermittent. That's why you need these conventional power sources. But as you mentioned, there's something called energy storage, whether that be batteries or in some other form. And that technology is rapidly developing. So what happens then is, for example, if those renewable assets are creating too much electricity for the grid to handle, it will then be stored there. And that energy can then be released at a later date when perhaps they aren't producing as much electricity. And so that then brings in the question, if we're relying on these conventional assets right now, like gas and to a lesser extent coal, how long is that going to go on for if energy storage suddenly comes along and solves that intermittency problem?
Yeah, are we close to solving it? Or I mean, there are ways you can invest in this. There are definitely companies investing quite heavily in this. Tesla is a good example of a company that's doing this.
Yes, there's Tesla, and there's kind of a smaller little player as well called it's the Gresham House Energy Storage Fund. That's kind of doing it at a very small level. But I mean, if you wanted to take a punt on energy storage, that would be a good one to go for. It's not massive yet, but it's definitely growing, and people are putting a lot of money into it, and it doesn't seem like it's one of these fads, because if we are going to push forward with renewables, we need this technology to work. So, you know, investment is going to pour into it, and this thing is going to grow.
I mean, there are loads of companies and funds that you mentioned in this piece.
Yes.
Ways to get access to a lot of the trends in energy. I mean, you've got examples of wind, how to invest in wind, and how to invest in solar. And,
yes.
What's your pick of the bunch?
With this whole thing, you can invest across the entire supply chain. For example, when it comes to wind, you can invest in, for example, Siemens is the one who makes actual turbines. But the consensus seems to be it's a bit more of a stable investment if you invest in the actual operational assets themselves. So if you want something kind of familiar, then SSE is really pushing into renewables. And they've openly said that they think renewables is going to be what underpins their future growth. If you perhaps wanted something that, you know, is slightly less familiar to a lot of people, there's a company called Ørsted. So it's a Danish company that used to be their state-owned oil and natural gas group. And they're actually the biggest offshore wind player in this country.
In the UK?
Yes.
Oh, right.
In the UK, they invest the most in it. Currently, they're developing what is the biggest offshore wind farm, but that's soon going to be taken over by an SSE joint venture project. So they didn't keep that mantle for too long.
I'm sure there'll be a bigger one at some point.
Yeah,
I mean, if Labour's targets are, you know, ever have to be delivered.
They're all trying to one-up each other right now to get that title. But, I mean, Ørsted took a little bit of a hit because they had to kind of lower their projections of how much electricity they were going to be generating kind of based on wind forecasts. One of the analysts who does a lot of coverage of them, RBC Capital Markets, they kind of say, well, they think that reaction's a little bit overdone. So now could actually be a good time to dive into Ørsted and it's going to see long-term growth because of, you know, the renewables push.
I love the quote you got here, that it's transitioned, quotes, from a black to a green energy company. And this is really fascinating, because there are so many companies out there that, I mean, going back to a lot of the ESG stuff we've been, and environmental investment stuff we've been discussing, a lot of companies that are on the investors' blacklist, as it were, could change.
Yeah, no, I mean, Ørsted is one which those ESG funds kind of champion, is kind of like, you know, look, this is, you know, a great stock because it's done what Lucy's described. I mean, also an interesting aspect to the whole debate, or, you know, the whole kind of, you know, what's driving the investments themes is the kind of cost of capital and who's actually going to be investing in these technologies. So with more people keen to invest in renewables because of it being, you know, the seen increasingly as the only game in town, really. It means it becomes cheaper to fund those projects, and the return, and so the returns are more attractive. Whereas the opposite's true of fossil fuels, and coal has experienced that. Yeah. And perhaps we've had this week news about the European Investment Bank not wanting to invest in any fossil fuels, which means that maybe gas is actually going, you know, or despite it being billed as a, you know, the consensus having been it's a transition technology and it's the fossil fuel, the good fossil fuel, is that maybe it's like, you know, there isn't a good fossil fuel soon in terms of finance, you know, people financing these things.
Yeah.
I mean, they are coming under pressure, kind of these oil and gas giants. I mean, they put a lot of money into betting that gas was going to be the next big fuel because of what's happening to coal.
Well, Shell certainly did, because obviously they bought BG.
Yes, precisely. I mean, and now lots of these companies are trying to boost their kind of green credentials. So in terms of the joint venture I mentioned earlier with SSC, that's actually Equinor that's put money in there. So, I mean, they are kind of slowly making that shift towards renewables because they see now that it wasn't just about the environmental concerns, it's now the economics of it, so they're going to have to make these changes.
I think that's a really interesting point, you know, the economics of this are what is making it work. I mean, yes, there is political pressure, and obviously you have these great big, you know, political declarations about the sort of carbon-free future.
Yes.
But it's the market that's going to get us there.
Yes. I mean, I think that's what we're waiting for, really, to give it that big push. I mean, you know, companies sort of paid a lot of lip service to it before, kind of these the green and the ESG, etc. But now, kind of, it's lit that fire under them because, you know, the money's there now.
Everything you seem to write about is environmental. You've had an amazing sector focus recently about plastic as well, which I thought was.
I know they're such interesting trends, and before it was just kind of, you know, they were just sort of interesting, but now, you know, they're financially interesting. So a lot of companies are putting money into it, and there's a lot of growth there as well.
It's a really, really fascinating feature.
I mean, yeah. No, I mean, one of the bits I love this feature, one of the bits which really stood out there also is when you talk about the government's aim to have the strike price for offshore wind at 100. Pounds per megawatt hour by 2020, and it's in fact come down to, as you said, 39 pounds, yeah, 965.
It just shows the progress that we've made, and you think if we've come that way in such a short time, where are we heading next?
It's absolutely extraordinary, and as I say, you know, it's the market that seems to be getting us there, and this is the thing I often think about, you know, when we look at the political backdrop and these, as you say, these great big declarations and sort of the one-upmanship that we're seeing in manifestos about green. It's actually companies who are doing this now, and it's investors' money that is making this happen.
I mean, also if you were kind of making a bet back in 2012, you would say we need nuclear and we need gas.
I wouldn't have, because I knew they were going to do.
You weren't living by where they're going to build. But I mean, you just can't judge innovation. You know, you can't. I mean, you can't. Forecast innovation.
Nuclear is a messy technology. No. I mean, you know, forget Fukushima or Chernobyl, which was an amazing series on Sky. Actually, if you've happened to watch that, but it's just a messy technology. It's complicated and expensive and dangerous if you don't get it right.
And also, if you think about kind of technological innovation, I mean, you look at things like renewables, and it's moving very quickly. And then you look at how long it takes to actually build a nuclear power plant. By the time that's finished, nuclear technology itself has already moved on and that plant is out of date.
Yeah, I find it absolutely fascinating. Obviously, there's a massive, massive political white elephant in that particular room, which is the fact that it's China that's involved in a lot of these projects as well. Yeah. And then geopolitics comes into play and obviously massive security concerns around these things. I like wind. And I do like seeing the old turbines going around in the distance. I think they're rather beautiful.
In terms of kind of the investment angle as well, I think UK investors can take a lot of comfort from the fact that the UK is actually the leader in the world with this. We're decarbonising faster than any country in the world. So, I mean, it's a good place for these type of investments.
I yeah, absolutely. Good old Britain, eh? Anyway, it's so fascinating, and thank you for your work on this feature. I think it's really brilliant, and obviously I'd advise you all to pick up the magazine as soon as you stop listening to us and go and have a listen. What else have you been writing about this week, Lucia? I know we've had some interesting results. Speedy Hire. Before we sign off, Speedy Hire, because you tipped this recently.
I did tip it recently. I actually really like this company. I mean, it's sort of bucking the trend, so everyone's a bit down on construction right now. There's kind of all this talk of the construction slowdown. What Speedy Hire has been doing to kind of stave this off is it's been making a big push into kind of the smaller medium enterprises. So what they're finding is that kind of segment of the market is still growing. So they've seen a little bit of a slowdown at the top, but it's this bottom level that's really pushing growth. And they're kind of doing some interesting things in terms of investing in AI as well and making themselves a lot more efficient.
AI? That's never something I expected to hear about in relation to equipment hire.
I know, it seems like everyone kind of mentions AI and kind of smart technology, etc. But in terms of Speedy Hire, what they're using it for is just simply to make sure that they have the right stock in the right place at the right time.
Mm. Actually, National Grid are using AI and grid management as well. It's really quite interesting.
I mean, everything's going smart these days.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we still like this one, I take it, after the results this week?
Yes, still like it. Everything's looking good.
Excellent. Well, what else have we had this week? Have you noticed anything, popped across your radar this week, Algie, that you thought, oh, that's quite interesting? The airline's quite interesting this week.
Yeah. We had EasyJet and
Wizz, which is doing well as well.
Yeah. And
EasyJet's tip of the year.
It is, yeah. I mean, they've come back remarkably strongly over the last quarter. The kind of share prices in that sector they've flown.
Why? I mean, these numbers were not great in and of themselves. What's happening here? And Wizz is struggling with aircraft orders, and we've had obviously the whole Boeing thing in the background.
Well,
it's a weird thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a funny industry though, airlines, because always when times are tough, that's often when the share prices are doing well, because it's all about, you know, capacity, how many planes are in the air. If there aren't enough, then you can put up seat prices. If there are too many, which is when times are good, people are putting too many planes up, then it's bad. Your yield goes down, and you know it's really hard business to manage. And then you have the great unknown of the fuel price as well.
So it's almost like you should invest in airlines countercyclically.
Oh, yeah. When you watch, classically, you watch for a big carrier to go under, and then that's the time to buy, essentially, because coming down the line is going to be a lack of capacity. Although they normally buy each other, they buy the assets.
Indeed. Stock markets. It's a funny old game.
funny old game.
Okay, brilliant. Well, thank you, Algie, and thank you, Nilushia. Really fascinating stuff. It's been a really busy week, the results.
Yes, they really wrapped
up. Oh my goodness. How long have you been here with us now?
Since March.
Since March. Did you hit the first result season earlier in the year? Yeah, the summer results season.
Yes,
so you get used to it after a while. 1,000 yards there starts to develop during results season. I think it's going to be busy next week as well. But we've got about 13, 14 pages of results this week. Biggies as well. What else we got? Alex J has put together a really interesting piece in the sector focus on the motorsport industry, which you don't really think about when you think about stock markets. But there's a green angle here as well. It's electric cars.
Yes. And I think actually a lot of the kind of technology is kind of starting off in kind of this Formula One developments as well before it makes it onto like the commercial cars that we actually drive.
Yeah, I mean, F1 was always funny. A lot of that stuff didn't make it into road cars, but actually I think it's Formula E, it's the electric side of things that's actually has much more relevance to the road car industry. And it's growing quickly, that sport.
Yes.
It's really, really, really fascinating. What else have we got? Michael Taylor is back this week looking at Level 2, which I know a lot of readers use when they're trading the markets. My God, it's complicated. Glad I don't do this full time, unlike Michael. Lots in the personal finance and funds section, which they will talk about on their podcast tomorrow. We've looked at politics a little bit more this week than I would generally like, mainly because of British Telecom and Labour's plans there to offer free broadband to everyone, which Phil and I spoke about last week. And Chris Dillo's looked at it as well, as has Paul Jackson in his No Free Lunch column.
Can't stay away from politics.
I really, 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 really wish I could. And I must go and read the manifesto. Thank you, Nilushi. Thank you, Algie. And thank you all for listening. Pick up the magazine and all good news agents. Profit from the energy revolution. How investors can navigate the UK's transition to renewable energy, which is happening very quickly. Thank you. See you next week.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.